From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. In 2002, Cory Doctorow co-wrote a book called Essential Blogging. Today, he's co-editor at the technology, culture, politics website Boing Boing, a columnist for The Guardian. And perhaps best known in recent years as the author of the best-selling young adult novel Little Brother. It's about Marcus Yellow, a hacker hero who's detained by the government and goes on to lead a squad of technologically savvy teenagers against the tyrannical security state. Cory Doctorow's sequel to Little Brother, Homeland, is being published today. In it, Marcus receives a WikiLeaks-style thumb drive with evidence of corporate and government evil. Thank you so much for coming by. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
And you flew in from London yesterday, still a little...
I did. I'm still jet-lagged. Your last interview was fascinating.
A little too late to have prepared for it, though. You said you wanted to write a story that helped kids see this invisible, all-powerful crisis unfolding around them. How would you describe that crisis?
So the first novel was about... kids whose city has had a terrorist attack against it. And we can all point to the terrorist attack. We all know what it is. But it's much harder to kind of put your finger on the root cause of why all of a sudden everyone you know is out of work and student debt is mounting up. And it seems like the economy doesn't run and yet the rich people are getting richer. And then there's another layer of invisibleness here because it's also about people whose devices stop working for them and start working against them and not knowing whether or not the webcam on your computer or the camera in your phone or the microphone in your phone are listening to you and who might be on the other end of them.
Has your book kind of inspired would-be Marcuses? You mentioned you spoke to 600 middle school kids today. Are they in it because it's a great story or are they actually getting motivated to be like that?
Both, I hope. Yeah. I mean, I think that what science fiction can do at its best is put a lot of meat on the bones of these abstract policy arguments about, you know, how should computers be regulated? How should the internet be regulated? You know, if you think back to like 1947 and someone said, look, I've got this great idea. We're going to put cameras everywhere and we'll be able to spot all the bad guys. And yeah, we'll video record all the good guys when they're walking around too. But if you've done nothing wrong, what do you have to fear? It's kind of this abstract argument about why not? Well, it would make me feel creepy. I wouldn't like it. But then George Orwell writes 1984, and all of a sudden we get this marvelous adjective. We can say, your plan to put cameras everywhere is Orwellian. And we can import the whole narrative of 1984. And I think that when you write science fiction stories that deal with important policy questions, you can start to move away from this very abstract, dry discussion and start talking about how it makes people feel.
If you're trying to be an activist and your activities are skirting or going over the line of the law, you've got security issues of your own, and which is why anonymous is anonymous. The teens in your novels kind of act collectively together. Is that hard to do, though, in real life when the revealing of one name can lead to others and can bring down a whole group of folks?
Yeah, ultimately, I think that the kids in this book start to question the value of secrecy. As much as they start off operating in secret, they realize that, as you say, if your security depends on what you do being a secret, then your security fails as soon as the secret goes away. It's much better to have a security that works even if your identity's secret is disclosed, and they work for better solutions. There are legitimate reasons for anonymity. There are legitimate reasons not to want to disclose your identity to the state or to other people. But ultimately, they find in going public some strength.
Did you get any good questions from the middle school students this morning?
Oh, yeah, I always do. And, you know, in part, I wasn't just talking to them about the book, but I was also talking to them about some other social issues, because one of the contributors to this book, a friend who wrote the afterword, killed himself last month. And so I talked to them about suicide and depression. We got some good questions about that. Also questions about how surveillance works on the internet, what they can do to stop it. I told them about a series of cases recently, starting from 2010 and moving forward, where companies and schools and governments have been caught using devices to secretly spy on people. And they talked about how they could secure their devices. It's really fun to see them kind of get their teeth in this, to realize that there is an information, that there is the kind of a means of information, and then realizing that they have it in their power to seize it, and then realizing that they must seize the means of information.
Author, columnist, then co editor at Boing Boing. Cory Doctorow is my guest. We're 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW if you've got a question for him. You alluded to Aaron Schwartz, the digital rights activist who committed suicide last month. He was being prosecuted by the Department of Justice for downloading academic articles. His girlfriend was out today on a blog saying it wasn't his depression. He did suffer from depression. It was the prosecution that really led him to take his own life. You knew him. Do you have any insight into that?
Well, Aaron definitely had depression. Lots of people have had depression. I've had moments where I felt very dark and didn't know that it would ever be light again, and yet I got through it. And I think that that Aaron's depression, whatever it was that occurred just before he committed suicide, was definitely situationally induced. That if he was depressed, it was at least in part due to the fact that representatives of an incredibly powerful state were proposing to put him in jail for decades for checking too many books out of the library. And I think that we start to enter a realm where that we're talking about a distinction without a difference. Of course he was depressed, right? I mean, that's by definition. People who commit suicide don't do so because they're so happy that they don't want to live anymore. But we can also talk about why he was depressed. And I don't mean to pathologize it, but I do think it's useful, especially in technology, where we often know an awful lot about what each other are up to, but not a lot about how we're feeling. It's useful to start talking about how we might intervene there.
It's, of course, a personal tragedy for Aaron Schwartz's friends and for his family. Is there a larger message here, a larger issue here in his death?
Well, sure. I mean, a lot of people have pointed to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is a decades-old piece of American legislation that's supposed to be anti-hacking legislation, but it defines hacking as exceeding your authorization on a computer that you don't own. And a lot of prosecutors and a few judges have taken the point of view that this means that if you violate any of the terms of service, those tens of thousands of words that you have to click through in order to use any modern service, that violating any of those terms of service makes you not just someone who's violated a contract, but a felon. Someone who's liable to go to jail. And many people have called for reform to the CFAA, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. But I think that more broadly, the situation that Aaron was in is really an indictment of the way that prosecution and sentencing works in this country, where prosecutors have available to them these amazing sentences that they can threaten people with. And so many of the cases that are federally indicted are never heard by a judge, never heard by a jury. Instead, there's a plea bargain, and that plea bargain is the result of a prosecutor saying to someone they've got under their eye, you know, you face 50 years, 100 years in jail. If you settle for five, we'll call it a day. And these people going, well, I can't afford to risk the decades, the rest of my life in jail. I'll settle for five too. And, you know, an astonishing number, more than 95% of the people who are federally indicted end up pleading out and going to jail. And, you know, that's not a society of laws. That's a society of men and women, where prosecutors essentially get to put anyone that they think is guilty in jail by coercing them into taking plea bargains.
The Newtown massacre resulted in a new wave of concern about trying to get some gun control legislation passed. Do you think that Aaron Schwartz's suicide, it's very fresh, but might it also lead to renewed efforts to try to change some of these policies you were just describing?
Sure. I think that, well, for certain, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act stuff is just a slam dunk. And we've already had Zoe Lofgren introduce something called Aaron's Law, which adds a simple preamble to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that says, notwithstanding all the below, violating terms of service isn't a felony, right? You know, if the rules say by, you know, clicking through here, you agree that I'm allowed to come over to your house and, you know, wear your underwear and punch your grandmother, it doesn't mean that refusing to allow me to do that makes you a felon. But I think that there's a lot of people who are considering the extent to which they felt like the fight for a fair and open policy for technology was kind of a long haul where the individual battles didn't matter as much as the war. And a lot of us are saying, you know, actually, we should fight to win. Every fight matters. And I think Aaron and the other people who worked on fighting SOPA and PIPA really taught us that, you know, I was in D.C. a week before SOPA was up for its hearing, and every insider I talked to...
And remind us what SOPA was.
SOPA was a loony copyright proposal for regulating the internet in America that would have given the government the power to arbitrarily censor websites without a court order on the grounds that they believed that it infringed copyright. And that would have essentially made it impossible to have any website where the general public were allowed to talk to each other, because in doing so, you would become responsible, as the person who owned the site, responsible for making sure that no one ever linked to a site where someone else had linked to a site that infringed on copyright, which is an impossible burden. It would have ended online conversation and turned it into sort of glorified cable TV. And so everybody said, don't bother. It's a slam dunk. But Aaron and the Fight for the Future people and other people who took up this cause found that if you get 8 million people calling and writing to their lawmakers in the space of a couple of weeks, that lawmakers say, you know, it's very hard to get reelected without these campaign contributions I'm so dependent on, but it's impossible to get reelected without votes. And they change.
Is the stake in the heart of SOPA? Will it come back?
Oh, I think SOPA's dead, but I think there's lots of other guises in which it'll come back. For example, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a multilateral trade agreement the U.S. is negotiating behind closed doors with many of its Pacific trading partners. We don't really know what's in it because it's secret. They don't allow NGOs in. They don't allow the press in. That, you know, Congress doesn't have any oversight of it because it's conducted by the administrative branch. But we've seen leaks, and they proposed crazy stuff like mandatory laptop searches at borders. Three strikes rules, where if you're accused of living with someone who's accused of downloading three or more copyrighted works, you and your family lose your internet for a year. Just, you know, completely beyond the pale stuff, which is what you get when you negotiate in secret, is you get farcical wish lists from the entertainment industry instead of balanced regulation and laws that actually take into account everyone's points of view.
Cory Doctorow is my guest. You might read him on Boing Boing. You might have read his first book, Little Brother, the bestseller. The new sequel to that, Homeland, is out right now. And you were talking about loopy copyright issues. You recently wrote about one that actually begins here in Seattle, Washington.
So, fellas, yeah, fellas, yeah, has your girlfriend got the butt? Hell yeah, shake it, shake it, shake it.
Yeah, that's Sir Mix-a-Lot and his original version of Baby Got Back. Well, a guy by the name of Jonathan Colton decided to do an adaptation of that. And then the TV show Glee decided to do an adaptation of Jonathan Colton's version of Baby Got Back. And now in the latest iteration, Jonathan Colton has made a parody of the version by Glee and put it out, and the money that he's raising for that is going to charity. And we can add another layer to this. It should be noted that Sir Mix-a-Lot's original version of Baby Got Back borrowed a sample from the 1986 electro single Technicolor by Channel One. So who in this string of events plagiarized? Who in this string of events appropriately appropriated other material? And so who's right and who's wrong here?
So let me just factually correct what the last bit here, which is that Jonathan didn't parody the Glee release. What he did was he took his original release and re-released it and said, it's a cover of the Glee version, which was even funnier and more arch and wry and weird. So Sir Mix-a-Lot sampled. I don't know if he licensed his sample or not. We have very little good case law on sampling. All the case law on sampling is about whether or not it's a de minimis, whether or not it's fair use, but not whether it's de minimis, right? So there's two ways that you might get around having to license a sample. The first one is whether or not it's fair use, and fair use is a very complicated legal doctrine. The other one is de minimis, which is it's just too small to bother a court with. No one's ever really heard that. We don't really have any case law on it. So the practice is to sample. It's pretty broken. Nobody can produce the kind of glorious sample-filled albums that we used to get at the dawn of hip-hop. Nobody will ever make an album like It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back.
Unless you're Girl Talk.
Well, unless you're Girl Talk, right? But he risks everything, right? I mean, I hope he's judgment-proof, because if he ever gets sued, he will be broken on the wheel of the American legal system. But, no one will ever produce Paul's Boutique. No one will ever produce It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. Those are the two most profitable hip-hop albums of all time. But if they cleared their samples, each one of them would have lost millions. So Sir Mix-a-Lot probably cleared his samples because he's with a label. And then Jonathan Colton covers Mix-a-Lot's music, and he does so by taking advantage of something called the mechanical license, which is a compulsory license. All composers have to allow other parties to cover their music, provided that they pay a set fee. That's how, you know, Sid Vicious recorded My Way, didn't get Paul Anka's permission first, you know. And so he's good. He's all right. Some may argue that his interpretation strays too much from the original to qualify as a cover, but that's, again, a distinction without a difference.
And no one's going to mistake them. No one's going to go, wait a minute, that's Sir Mix-a-Lot, because reimagined the song.
He's good in he's good in terms of copyright law. Like, he paid his license. Yeah. He's good, right? He could produce a totally identical sound alike so long as he paid his license.
So now Glee comes along.
Right. And what they do is totally legal too, right? They cover it and they use Colton's arrangement, and Colton's not entitled to stop them from doing it. But what they did was plagiarism, because what they did was they characterized their almost note for note reissue of Jonathan Colton's very distinctive arrangement as original. And that's not illegal, in the same way that claiming to have written Shakespeare is not illegal. But we kick kids out of school, and we kick profs out of university, and we fire columnists for plagiarizing, because it's fraud. It's a lie. And given that they were selling their arrangement, they had it in the iTunes store, and they didn't acknowledge what was clearly the truth, I think a lot of us feel that if you're going to sell goods, that you should fairly label them. And what they labeled this as was their original arrangement. And what they should have labeled it as is their slavish reproduction of Jonathan Colton's arrangement.
And Colton didn't even get a mention either, did
yeah.
he? It was just completely appropriate. Now, do the Glee people owe Sir Mix-a-Lot a check?
Yeah, they probably paid him his mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably negotiated a separate sync right for the TV rights too.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it shows you that the laws that are passed when the industry is in charge of making sure that copyright is reflects their needs often strays very far from what people actually perceive of as the fair deal for copyright. A lot of people would go, well, why isn't plagiarism illegal? I think that would probably be going too far, but I think that we can all agree that plagiarism is a form of dishonesty, and that it constitutes unsavory corporate behavior from Fox. The other dimension, of course, to this is that everybody loves Jonathan Colton because he's a really nice guy who makes witty, lovely songs, and he's an independent artist, and he's really made it on his own through scrappiness and pluck.
Whereas Glee,
well, Fox is a giant media conglomerate owned by a horrible, you know, Australian man, and I think a lot of people went, you know, as between the horrible Australian man and his progeny, and this lovely, you know, bearded Jonathan Colton, I'll take the lovely bearded Jonathan Colton.
Jonathan Colton's cover we heard there. Cory Doctorow, thank you so much for coming by. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.
The new book, the sequel to Little Brother, is called Homeland, and it's out now. David Hyde produces our show with Arwen Nix. We get production help from Cameron Drews and Amber Cortez, and Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.